From the studios of Wavefront Audiovisual Engineering in Schenectady, New York, this is Little Brother, the show where we talk about high technology, low intelligence, crime, greed, corruption, and all of the wonderful things that happen when you mix them together. Like any responsible little brother, we tell on Big Brother. My name is Chuck Ritter, and I'll be your host as we explore this world of the high tech. This is episode 147 of Little Brother for the 27th of April, 2022. Stay tuned. Little Brother is right around the corner. As always, I'd like to remind everyone that the opinions and views expressed in this program are strictly those of the participants, not necessarily those of anyone else who may, for whatever reason, attempt to claim them. Responsible parties with an opposing viewpoint may request an opportunity for a rebuttal. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can write me at critter@littlebrotherpodcast.com, or you can post a message on the blog at littlebrotherpodcast.com. So, let's get started. The BBC is reporting that a case has been brought in the High Court in London against dating app Grindr. Grindr is a dating app that is specifically targeting the LGBT community. The case alleges that the app has inappropriately revealed the HIV status of its users. A spokesperson for Grindr has stated that the corporation is, as one would expect, taking privacy, quote, extremely seriously, end quote. Of course they are. Missouri, 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 what are we going to do with you? The Attorney General of Missouri, Andrew Bailey, has sued nonprofit journalistic watchdog Media Matters for America for refusing to cooperate with an investigation. The investigation alleges that the nonprofit solicited donations from Missourians under false pretenses with the goal of so-called bullying advertisers off of social media platform X. Take a moment with that one. How a small-budget nonprofit can bully deep-pocketed corporate advertisers is not made clear by any statement that the AG has made. As part of a settlement centered around Google's Chrome web browser, Google will be deleting from its servers the data of millions of users who were in so-called incognito mode when their data were collected by the browser and sent to Google. On entering incognito mode in Google Chrome, a message greets you that, quote, now you can browse privately, end quote. The lawsuit alleges that this statement was somewhat economical with the truth, and the fact that there are data to delete kind of supports that allegation. Target is the target of a class action lawsuit in Illinois. The lawsuit claims that Target's surveillance systems collect biometric data about patrons unbeknownst to them. Illinois state law requires both notification and consent for such collection, and the lawsuit alleges that Target does not meet this standard. New York City Mayor Eric Adams has proposed to use full-body scanners at entrances to the New York City subway. The scans have raised concerns about potential violations of the Fourth Amendment to the U.S. Constitution, which protects people from unreasonable searches and seizures. Adams claims that the scanners will enhance public safety. This claim stands in stark contrast to the New York City crime rate, which is at a two-year low. I've mentioned before that law enforcement has had the ability for some time to buy data from data brokers that would have been a violation of the Fourth Amendment to the U.S. Constitution for them to collect directly. As of this podcast, a bill has passed in the U.S. House of Representatives that would require law enforcement to get a warrant before they would be able to make such purchases. The bill is now before the Senate. President Biden, however, has indicated that he opposes the bill, and so it might get vetoed. By now, the news has probably already reached you, but I'll mention it anyhow. A bill that has been dubbed the TikTok ban has passed both houses of the U.S. Congress and has been signed into law by President Joe Biden. Calling it a TikTok ban is not exactly accurate, as it's not quite that simple. It's more accurately a TikTok forced sale under penalty of ban. Anyway, TikTok's parent company ByteDance has until January 19th of next year to make the sale. The deadline may be extended if a sale is pending by that date. Finally, as if we were not already advertised at enough, XDA Developers is reporting that the most recent optional release of Windows 11 adds advertising to the Start menu. The advertisements come in the form of recommended apps, some of which, of course, carry a price tag. And those are the headlines. You're listening to Little Brother. We have a security alert for this fortnight. The maintainers of the PuTTY SSH and Telnet client have identified that versions 0.68 through 0.80 are vulnerable to CVE-2024-31497, which allows an attacker who possesses the public key and a few dozen signed messages to successfully recover the private key. The latest is version 0.81, so if you are using a version in that range, patch your systems. Well, here we are again. It's time for another round of Who Got Pwned Recently. There has been a lot of pwnage in the month since my last episode, so this is going to be kind of a lightning round. Ready? Let's go. We start with AT&T. NPR is reporting that AT&T are investigating how the private information of around 70 million current and former customers landed on the dark web. The telecom provider have stated that they are changing the passcodes of affected current customers, which is nice and all, but doesn't actually solve the problem of the data being out. Houston TV station KPRC, that's Channel 2 in Houston, are reporting that a class action lawsuit has launched already alleging negligence on the part of AT&T. The Open Worldwide Application Security Project, better known as OWASP, is concerned that they may have been breached after the discovery that an internal wiki server was hosting approximately 1,000 resumes. The organization believes that the server was not generally accessible from the outside of the organization. However, the information should have been confidential even within the organization, and so the server has been shut down appropriately. Jackson County, Missouri, there we go again with Missouri, declared a state of emergency earlier in the month as a response to a suspected ransomware attack. This has shut down the operations of many of the county offices. However, the election office remains operational, which is especially relevant in the face of a special election taking place at the same time as the attack. Cisco is acknowledging that Duo, a multi-factor authentication provider it acquired in 2018, has been breached. Duo operates based on text messages, which is already less than ideal. However, the breach allows for the attacker to acquire message logs pertaining to what was sent by the server. The breach occurred using an employee's credentials that were acquired by way of a phishing attack. A cyber attack hit the New York state government right in the middle of the process of drafting the state's annual budget. The budget drafting was completed nonetheless. It is unlikely that any delay would be a significant hindrance, however, to the operation of the state, as the state budget has been delivered late, more years than not, for decades. A couple of episodes back, I mentioned that Change Healthcare, a subsidiary of United Healthcare, got breached. As a recap, they are not a company that most of us would have dealt with directly, but rather a company that manages payments to pharmacies and doctors on behalf of other insurers. In episode 145, I mentioned that the ransom was paid only to have the ransomware gang disappear from the internet. Well, this just got worse. As is usually the MO for ransomware gangs, they collected a tranche of data prior to encrypting the systems, which they can sell in the event that they are unable to collect the ransom. Since it appears that someone made off with a ransom payment, they are now putting the data up for sale. Don't worry, you're probably on that list. In episode 145, I mentioned that the Computer and Infrastructure Security Agency, or CISA, were breached, and that this was particularly embarrassing. Well, now we have the nonprofit cybersecurity firm MITRE Corporation, the canonical keeper of the Catalog of Common Vulnerabilities and Exposures, or CVEs, that CISA uses in their bulletins, has also been breached. Two vulnerabilities in the Avanti Connect Secure Gateway were used to get into the network, and yes, both of the vulnerabilities are in the fucking catalog. And that's your lightning round of who got pwned this time. Enough news items cross my path that are related to infrastructure and supply chain issues that I've decided, starting in this episode, to add a segment about it. You could also think of this as prepper-related in a way, but ultimately what I'm here to talk about is where things are breaking down that are going to cause issues, possibly big ones, for average people, not just the technological elite and the cybersec and hacker crowd. Where possible, I will also include information about what you can do to protect yourself against these problems. To start the news section off, I have two stories this fortnight. The first item I have concerns the city of Muleshoe, Texas. What an incredibly Texas name for a city. One of the critical facilities that Muleshoe, like most cities and many other municipalities across the country, provides to its citizens is water. Living in such an area, you don't need to drill a well, power a pump, and hope that it produces clean drinking water for you and your family. The city, either for a fee or via taxes, has a centralized facility that pumps, stores, filters, and disinfects water before sending it into homes, hopefully not through lead pipes, throughout the municipality in a maze of pipes that are going down every street. You don't have to worry about it. You turn the tap and water comes out. And this works well as long as it works. So what happened in Muleshoe, however, is that the city was on the receiving end of a cyber attack in January. In the postmortem, the determination was made that this attack was of Russian origin. Operators were able to detect the attack and bring it to a halt before the supply was actually affected. Now, there's not a lot of clarity as to whether the attack was politically or monetarily motivated, and indeed those aren't mutually exclusive, but ultimately, this is of little importance if you turn the tap and the water isn't fit for use, or worse, not even there. As a general rule, I recommend that people should maintain a supply of water on hand to last about 3 days. The U.S. Center for Disease Control suggests that a 3-day supply should be about 3 gallons per person. That's about 12 liters for those of us who would prefer sane measures. This is something that you should prepare for now if you haven't already, to make sure that you are ready for this sort of event. If you wait until it happens, you may well find out that the grocery store shelves are empty. The other item I have in this vein concerns the emergency 911 service that we all know as the chief way to summon police, ambulance, fire department, etc. It seems as though for a period of several hours earlier this month, telephone customers in 4 states, Nebraska, Nevada, South Dakota, and Texas, were unable to use this number due to an outage. There will be meetings about this, I'm sure, and those meetings might produce some action items. However, despite that, if you're in the affected area and need help now, you need to know how to get it. I'm old enough to remember the time before 911. In a nutshell, we had to know the phone numbers of our local emergency services. In particular, I remember that my local fire department was 767-2211. I imagine that number probably still works, but that number was burnt into my memory for a very long time from a very young age. Every police department, fire department, ambulance squad, etc., they all have conventional phone numbers that can be used to call them. The 911 dispatch center probably has one as well. The thing that you will want to do is get these phone numbers into a place where you can find them. Mine are on a refrigerator magnet in my kitchen, courtesy of the city I live in. Get them together. Get them where you can find them when you need them. A couple of years ago, in episodes 46 and 48... Wow, that was a while ago, eh? I spoke about an attack that could be used on systems that read QR codes, those now ubiquitous 2D barcodes that we all know and love. Quick refresher, there's a specific string of text called the ICAR string, that is spelled E-I-C-A-R, that is used as a test target for antivirus software. The string is itself completely harmless, and it's devised to be something that is unlikely to happen accidentally. When antivirus finds it, it's supposed to respond to it as though it had found an actual virus, so that you can use this harmless string to confirm that the antivirus software is doing what it is supposed to do. You can get this very easily by going to www.icar.org and clicking the button in the upper right corner that says Download Anti-Malware Test File, and then downloading the text version. Do be careful with it, though. It might set off your antivirus. Anyway, the idea behind the ICAR QR attack, or EIQR as I dubbed it at the time, is that you present this barcode to a reader and the reader loads it to a server that has antivirus and the antivirus detects it and it rips apart the database behind the service. All right. So why am I bringing this up now? Well, it seems like a user of X Twitter, who goes by Laughing Mantis, has suggested using the string to determine if a website is storing passwords as plain text. When you go to set your password on a site that you suspect, you paste in the ICAR string. Hopefully, nothing happens. If the site or service is properly hashing or encrypting the passwords, the antivirus software won't see the ICAR string. If not, well, who knows? You might knock the site down, making the internet just a little bit more secure in the process. I mentioned in the last episode that auto insurance companies have figured out that they can purchase data about your driving habits from whoever made your car. I told the story of Romeo Chico in particular, who demanded an explanation from his insurer for his skyrocketing rates, only to be presented with a list of, I don't know, let's call them infractions, driving habits that the insurer didn't like the look of. The author of the article in the New York Times has reported that she has been absolutely inundated with requests and comments about her story. Apparently, there's a lot of this going on. General Motors claims that customers consented to this monitoring. At first blush, it appears as though the so-called consent may have been buried deep in other agreements, surrounded by discussion of the benefits of various other programs that the automakers have offered. At this point, it seems like General Motors is on the receiving end of at least 10 lawsuits regarding this practice, suggesting that customers have had enough. I have no information to report on the other major automakers, but they're in the business of making money, and data is at this point a proven revenue string, so make of that what you will. We have a few OPSEC-related items this time round, so let's hit it. Let's start with a couple of ways that you could get pwned. SIM swapping is a technique to take over someone's mobile phone service. In a nutshell, a phone company employee is persuaded, usually by social engineering, to cancel someone's service and to move that service to a new SIM card which the attacker controls. In order to achieve this, the attacker will typically find some helpful, sympathetic employee and spin a tale about a lost or stolen phone and the urgency with which they need to regain control of their service so that they can get their two-factor authentication codes for work, their bank, Facebook, whatever. This attack, by the way, is why you want your two-factor authentication to be based on something other than a text message. It's too easily ripped away from you. Anyway, the new twist on this is bribery. It seems as though T-Mobile employees are reporting being offered cash to swap SIMs. Now, this is not a problem that's going to be specific to T-Mobile. I would find it very hard to believe that the same or similar offers aren't being made to employees of other carriers as well, and the implications of it are kind of disturbing. Now, all that said, SIM swaps for cash are probably going to be limited to high-profile targets because obviously it's a costly proposition for the attacker, commensurate with the considerable risk that the employee is taking by accepting the bribe. Still, it's something to keep in mind, unless, of course, there's a double cross involved here as well. By the way, I feel like I need to mention that we can't lay this problem at T-Mobile's feet. There are probably steps that they can take to train employees to reject such requests, and maybe they have, and maybe that's why we know about it. But this is not a breach on T-Mobile, as had been the case with so many other times that they've been mentioned on this podcast. That brings us to a similar problem with LastPass. LastPass, for the unfamiliar, is a password manager, or password vault, whatever you want to call it. You use it to store strong, hard-to-memorize passwords, and it will provide ways to retrieve them on demand and fill in password fields as you go. It stores your passwords in the cloud, encrypted and protected by a password that you know. Now, my spidey senses tingle whenever I hear something is stored in the cloud, especially something sensitive like all my passwords. It's not necessarily bad in and of itself, but it does put them conveniently in one place for an attacker, which brings us to the here and now. So, what exactly is the news here? Well, it seems as though a recent run of phishing attacks have been particularly high quality. I mean, like, really high quality. You'll get a phone call from an 888 number claiming that your LastPass account has seen some unexpected activity, and asking you, was it you or not? When you select no, you get a call from a person, typically a person with an American accent, claiming to be a LastPass employee. They send an email to reset your password, and boom, they now have your password. It's probably an expensive campaign, but it's also probably pretty high yield. In other news, TechCrunch is reporting that Meta, the parent company of Facebook, WhatsApp, and others, had an operation that it called Project Ghostbusters. First off, I am annoyed that they besmirched my favorite film with that name, but whatever. Anyway, Project Ghostbusters was named for the ghost logo used by Snapchat, and the objective was to intercept and decrypt Snapchat traffic, something which is literally none of their business. This information came to light as a result of a class action lawsuit in California brought against Meta by its consumers. It appears from the court documents as though Meta was trying similar tactics against YouTube, Amazon, and others. My recommended course of action here is to remove any Meta-owned apps from your devices. Clearly, they are not to be trusted. As usual, we'll end the show with the fail of the fortnight. It's often said that there is no cloud. It's just someone else's computer. While there are many articles out there on the internet, in the cloud as it were, that refute this interpretation of cloud computing, every once in a while, something happens to remind us of the fundamental truth behind the expression. Customers of Bell Canada's Fibe TV, who have subscribed to Cloud DVR as part of their package, have just experienced such an event. It seems that, with little notice or fanfare, the service has set to 61 days, the length of time that you might be allowed to retain a recording on your Fibe TV Cloud DVR. Now, I have to say, I've always been a little apprehensive of DVRs in general, as so many of them don't have a way to export content from the device, although mine does. One never even imports it in this case. I would speculate that the servers aggregate all of the requests to record a particular channel at a particular time into a single recording on the storage devices in their data centers, which, I might add, is very efficient, but it gives the paying customer even less control over the content available. The idea of aging out content is, I suppose, understandable to a degree. One Twitter user actually did ask Bell Canada about this and was told that it was to save space. Okay, I get it. But if you're going to offer a service like this, it is on you to provision it appropriately. So I am not particularly sympathetic to that argument. Maybe a more reasonable deadline, say a year, might be a better stance to take. 61 days is just too short. Now, speaking as somebody who has many years of recordings, and I'll mention that I have them exported for safekeeping, that were recorded using a DVR. Recordings that I keep for research purposes. Recordings that I want not to fall into some Orwellian memory hole. I find this development particularly revolting. Little Brother is produced, recorded, edited, and hosted by yours truly, Chuck Ritter. Special thanks to Fongaboo and the crowd at Helix for web hosting support. Shout out to the Albany 2600 group. Special thanks to Thriller at Play, Psycho, Azrael, The Axe That Slayed Me, Joe Cadillac, Ed, Knight Rider 007, and Misdemeanor for story leads. Our headline music is Adrenochrome by Super Action 80, Our Who Got Pwned music is Analog Summer 3 by Asarhad. Our Fail of the Fortnite music is Space Reggae by Zap. Our opening theme music and bumper is Around Chaos by Heatseeker, and our closing theme is Space Debris by Captain Image. If you have questions or comments about this podcast or want to join the conversation, please drop me an email at critter@littlebrotherpodcast.com or post a message on the blog at littlebrotherpodcast.com. Join us next time when Little Brother tells on Big Brother once again. Episode 148 will drop on the 11th of May. Stay safe and be well. All over again, because I can hear my breath rubbing against the fucking mic. The show where we talk about high technology, higher volume levels than the one I'm currently recording, and all of the wonderful things that happen when you put them through a mixer. There is a house in New Orleans. The only reason I don't owe royalties for that is that's a folk song. About patrons, this is not Patreon. You know something? I honestly feel like I want to start this entire episode over. You know, I'm looking at these levels and I really feel that they are too fucking low. Let's try that again. The first item I have concerns the city of Muleshoe, Texas. Sorry, Muleshoe. Let's try that again. Living in such an area, you don't need to drill a well. Let's try that again.
We did the thing!